we will hear a short introduction to this series by William Sook, the director of the Superfund Research Program. He is also the chief of the Hazardous Substances Research Branch in the NIEHS Division of Extramural Research and Training. Dr. Sook has served as the director of NIEHS Superfund Research Program since its inception, 1986. He received his PhD in microbiology from George Washington University Medical School and his Master's of Public Health in Health Policy from the School of Public Health at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Sook, I would like to introduce you and pass it over to you now.
Thank you, Heather. I appreciate it, and greetings to all. The Superfund, the NIEHS Superfund Research Program is hosting this seminar series to highlight SRP-funded projects around the country that support innovation in water technologies and research. Even in the United States, clean water is not always assured. Improvements in water quality have dramatically improved the public's health in the United States. However, some old challenges remain and new ones are emerging. This webinar series complements recent federal government environmental initiatives, including the December 14, 2015 White House Roundtable on Water Innovation, to bring together leaders from industry, government, and academia to discuss approaches for fostering innovation in the water sector and boosting water sustainability. The SRP funds multidisciplinary research addressing the complex and evolving challenges associated with Superfund and related hazardous waste sites. Some of this funded research, however, can be directly applicable to addressing challenges in water quality and the development of the next generation of water technologies. Our mandates call for the development of advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of human health effects of hazardous substances, the development of methods to assess the risks to human health presented by hazardous substances, the development of methods and technologies to detect hazardous substances in the environment, and finally, the development of basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and/or toxicity of hazardous substances. To address these mandates, a number of SRP projects relate to water remediation, detection of contaminants in water, toxicology, epidemiology, and community engagement of high relevance to drinking water. These advances highlight the implications of exposure to hazardous substances, but also provides an opportunity to develop targeted intervention strategies. The SRP uses an integrated research model to develop new solutions to complex problems. The P42 Center concept is meant to cover the broad mandates through a multi-project center with a variety of health and environmental disciplines, as well as training, engagement, and research translation, all tied together and integrated under a unifying theme. This formalized mechanism within our grant structure requires that toxicology and epidemiology researchers interfaced with monitoring and remediation researchers. Using drinking water as an example, you might think of the left as being the identifying the problem, quote unquote, and the right as the quote unquote the solution. But really, the engineering approaches only take us there part way. Achieving access to clean drinking water requires policy that is informed by rigorous science. It also requires adoption of new technologies that are user-friendly. Investment in epidemiology and toxicology research delivers science-based policy for safe drinking water. SRP researchers are contributing to these advances by identifying exposure and determining methods to prevent or reduce those exposures. A first step in public health research is identifying exposures that may cause harm. SRP researchers are detecting metals and other contaminants in drinking water and have linked them to a variety of health outcomes, including preterm birth, cancer, neurodevelopmental outcomes, and decreased lung function. A subsequent step in the progression of public health research is to determine methods to prevent and reduce harmful exposures. SRP researchers are improving cleanup of aquifers at hazardous waste sites and increasing the efficiency to immobilize or remove contaminants from water, which both contribute to improving drinking water. In addition to health advances, new monitoring and remediation technologies are underway within the university and small business grants funded by SRP. Monitoring and remediation researchers can work with health researchers to help set goals for technology innovation. They have to know what would be considered quote-unquote clean before they can figure out how to achieve quote-unquote clean water. SRP researchers are developing monitors for contaminants in water, soil, and sediments. This includes real-time monitoring as well as untargeted monitoring for a wide range of contaminants. SRP researchers are also investigating methods and technologies for direct treatment of contaminated sediment and water. This includes testing new approaches for treating emerging contaminants that are difficult to remove with existing technologies. These novel technologies may allow water treatment to operate more efficiently, more cost efficiently, and with greater public safety. Here are some examples of technologies being developed in the SRP. The SRP is a technology-driven program, and innovative technologies in water assessment and purification have been at the forefront of research since the program's inception. The overall goal of these technologies is to reduce exposure, thereby reducing the burden of disease and ill health. We foster and support these innovative technologies, and they are being developed in an integrated way with the other pieces of the program. As I mentioned, SRP has a long-standing history of research in water and monitoring and remediation for a variety of chemicals. SRP researchers have been involved in many of these activities using chemical and agent-specific approaches. To put this into perspective, this chart shows the contaminants studied in SRP water monitoring and remediation projects funded in fiscal years 2011 through 2015. I'm going to let you look at that for a second. For those of you who don't know, Dean Epples are dense, non-aqueous phase liquids, MTBE, methyl terbutyl ether, and PCE is tetrachloroethylene. Okay? All right. Another aspect of water research is technology transfer to reach end users. To reach regulatory agencies, health investigators take initiatives to serve on panels such as IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IRIS, the Integrated Risk Information System, and CMERC, or the Coastal and Marine Mercury Ecosystem Research Collaborative, a collaborative spearheaded by our Dartmouth Superfund Research Center. An example to reach water industry is recent engagement between integrated water systems and groups such as the EPA water clusters and technology developers, and to utilize best practices for community engagement by researchers to reach communities. Data integration and sharing also provide other opportunities to reach end users. Transparency of results can build confidence in these new technologies. Data sharing and integration is an area of interest to the SRP. We are currently planning the subsequent webinars in this series and hope you will join us on the webinars to come. They will be scheduled soon, so stay tuned. These are the areas that we're looking at right now under the SRP Water Innovation Program of this webinar series. So I want to thank you. And for more information about the SRP, visit our website. If you are not able to attend the two webinars we held on SRP Small Business Water Innovation, I encourage you to check out the archives. The sessions held in March highlighted sustainable approaches to remediation and innovation and innovative detection technology related to water. Links to the archives are available from our Small Business Progress in Research website. Also, feel free to contact us if you have any questions or you want any additional information. Turn it back to Heather. And I'm going to turn this back over to Heather for the remainder of this session. And I also want to thank the presenters who are going to be giving this session today. Thank you all.
Thank you, Dr. Sook, and thank you for making that connection between the Superfund research program and how the products from that research program can be used in addressing the issues that we have with water. We did get a couple of questions. We will get back to those questions offline because the questions had a little bit were kind of logistical questions. So we'll get back to those people shortly. But at this time, what we'd like to do is introduce our first speaker, David Sedlak. Pull up his slide right now. David Sedlak is from the University of California Berkeley Superfund Research Program. He is a Maslamoff Professor of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Berkeley. In addition to being an investigator at the Berkeley SRP Center, he is also the co-director of the Berkeley Water Center. His research has addressed water reuse, treatment, and use of urban runoff, and treatment of contaminated groundwater from industrial sites. In addition to his laboratory and field research, Dr. Sedlak is interested in the development of new approaches for managing the urban water cycle. He pursues these efforts through research coordinated through the National Science Foundation's Engineering Research Center for reinventing the nation's urban water infrastructure, also known as RENEW-IT. He's also the editor-in-chief of the ACS journal, Environmental Science and Technology, and the author of Water, Point 4, a book that examines the ways in which we can gain insight into solutions to current and future problems by understanding the history of urban water systems. So it's with great pleasure that I would like to introduce Dr. David Sedlak.
Thank you, Heather. Thanks for having me, and thanks, Bill, and the rest of the SRP staff for organizing the webinar. And thanks to all the listeners out there who are willing to share some of your day with us to hear something about the big picture associated with the connection between water supply and Superfund. I'm really happy to be kicking off this series of webinars where we're trying to highlight the connections between research on hazardous waste management and the overall topic of the water supply and public health. You know, in many ways, this is getting us back to our roots. After all, the whole inspiration for the Superfund program was the concern about human exposure to contaminants, and much of that concern had occurred through exposure to contaminated groundwater. But in some ways, we're victims of our own success, because as the Superfund program and the efforts of various people around the world have led to the development of more sophisticated remediation technologies and detection technologies and public health understanding of contaminants, we've cleaned up some of the worst waste sites. And we increasingly find ourselves looking at hazardous waste sites where there's not really a clear groundwater exposure pathway, or we focus on other ways that people are exposed to contaminants, like through the air or through the food supply. But I hope to show you today that the problems associated with contaminated water haven't gone away. And in some ways, some of the concerns about where we're going to find our water supply in the future are driving us back to our roots to think more about how hazardous waste can lead to human exposure to contaminants. And so that's what I'm hoping to establish in this initial webinar. So for me personally in California, a lot of the motivation for thinking about new types of water supplies is the current drought. And if you look at this figure here, which shows you runoff in the Sacramento River, which is really, in some ways, the switching yard of California's complex water system, you'll see that we've been in a drought for quite a while. So the dotted line in this figure shows you the long-term average flow in the Sacramento River. And you can see that before 2006, we were kind of bouncing along more or less at the average. But for eight of the past 10 years, we've been severely below our normal runoff. That is, if I put the year 2016 in here, it's more or less an average year. But all the way back in 2007, we've been getting about half of what we normally expect. And that's put a great deal of strain on the state. And you've probably read about that in the newspapers, or if you're in the West, you've even seen it directly in your food prices and people talking more and more about water conservation. But I can assure you, this concern about water supplies is not unique to California. This figure, which got a little bit messed up on the being transposed to the internet here, shows you the levels of water in Lake Mead. And what it's showing you is that Lake Mead in the water supply just outside of Las Vegas, which is responsible for much of the urban water supply throughout the Southwest, has been going down since about 2000. And by the year 2015, it's dropped below 1,100 feet. And there are some models that hydrologists have made that suggest that we may not be even able to draw water out of Lake Mead within the next 20 or 30 years. And so there are great concerns about the West's imported water supply. And we can only expect this problem to get worse in the future. These two figures, which come from the 2013 IPCC report, show you the expectations about runoff and soil moisture in the period from 2016 to 2035 under the RCP scenario 4.5, which is more or less the direction that most of us are hoping that we're heading in the near future with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. And the way you read these figures is you look at the places that are yellow and orange and red as the places that are going to get drier. And what you can see is that in terms of runoff, much of the country, especially the West and Southwest, is going to have less runoff. But probably more importantly, looking at soil moisture, most of the country is going to have less soil moisture as the planet gets warmer. And what that means is that our traditional ways of gathering water from imported water sources and reservoirs are going to become less effective. And the demand for water for agriculture and cooling is going to grow. And so many of us are very concerned about our over-reliance on the system of water supply that developed in the 20th century. In fact, when I talk about this system of water supply, I often talk about the need for a fourth urban water revolution. So on the right, you'll see the cover here for Water 4.0, the book that I wrote to introduce lay audiences to the history of our water supply and where it's coming from and some of the challenges that it's facing. And if you're more of a visual learner, you can see my thoughts on this in a 12-minute TED Talk that was posted in the fall, which you can find just by searching my name and looking at the TED channel. But really what I want to do today is I want to talk about the things that I normally discuss when I give a talk on that fourth urban water revolution and the way in which hazardous waste might play a role in either serving as a barrier for realizing the goal of breaking our reliance on imported water, or the way in which technologies from this coming water revolution will improve our ability to clean up hazardous waste sites. And so when I normally talk about this fourth urban water revolution, I talk about the need to replace our system of imported water supply, that is water that falls in reservoirs or groundwater aquifers that we use for centralized water supply for city, to replace this with four new types of water supplies, which I liken to faucets, and they're stormwater harvesting, water reuse, that is recycling municipal wastewater effluent, water use efficiency, and seawater desalination. And today I want to spend a few minutes giving you examples of how Stormwater harvesting and water reuse might be affected by the presence of hazardous waste and contaminated sites, and the way in which technologies being developed to enable seawater desalination might actually feed back into the Superfund program and allow us to have more effective means of site remediation. So let's start by thinking about this concept of stormwater harvesting. So this is one of the ways in which we make sure that we have enough water to drink in California. This figure shows you a picture of the Montebello Forebay in Whittier, California. And what you see on the left-hand side is the river, such as rivers pass for in the western United States sometimes, essentially a concrete channel. This river is actually managed for flood supply in the winter, and in the summertime, the reservoirs in the mountains outside of Los Angeles gradually release the water that they stored during the wintertime, and it gets routed into what were former sand quarries or places of high permeability in the recharge zone of the aquifer. And this is the way in which engineers have developed to recharge the aquifers east of the city of Los Angeles. And this is responsible for about 15% of Los Angeles's water supply. So here's a map showing you some of the primary basins where groundwater is augmented and supplied to the people of Los Angeles through this system of capturing water in the San Gabriel and Santa Susana Mountains and sending it down into the San Fernando Valley and the San Gabriel Valley, where it recharges the aquifer and then is drawn out as a public water supply. So this is a pretty neat way of storing winter rainfall in a place with a Mediterranean climate and getting it into the ground in a place that's very highly urbanized, where you probably wouldn't have enough unpaved surfaces to get it to the aquifer. And everything would be going just fine if it weren't for our legacy of groundwater contamination and Superfund sites. So some of the nation's most notorious Superfund sites were associated with the aerospace industry, and they were located in the San Fernando and San Gabriel Valleys. And so these figures from the USGS just show you the extent of the groundwater plumes where contamination with things like TCE, perchlorate, hydrazine, and hexavalent chromium have contaminated the aquifer. And over the last three decades, the principals who are responsible for this contamination have spent millions of dollars in remediation, but it still hasn't prevented the plumes of contamination from taking the drinking water wells out of service. And in fact, the city of Los Angeles is currently in the process of designing and building a groundwater treatment system that will cost them between $600 and $800 million. And so this lifeline to Los Angeles is endangered by these former hazardous waste sites. And this is pretty unfortunate, because one of the main strategies that we're thinking about for augmenting water supplies in a drying West involve capturing the urban runoff that falls within the city and getting it into the ground in recharge zones. So this figure here just gives you a schematic, and I'm sure the hydrogeologists in the audience are familiar with this general concept, but if we can capture rainwater when it falls in recharge zones, you know, remember, we have a Mediterranean climate where it rains maybe only five or six times a year, but it rains quite a bit each time. If we could capture that rainfall in the city, we can do the same thing that we've been doing all along with the water that falls in the mountains outside of the city, but capturing this urban rainfall, we can get it into the ground and augment these important groundwater supplies. Just to give you an example of what we're talking about, this figure here shows you a project that the city of Los Angeles is currently building near Burbank called the Rory M. Shaw Wetland Park. And what the city has done is they've spent about $50 million acquiring some land, a lot of it which happened to have been a former hazardous waste site, where there was a gravel quarry. And what they're doing is they're lining the gravel quarry, shown here in the foreground, so it can capture the runoff that falls within the adjacent neighborhood. So instead of routing the storm sewers from this neighborhood into the Los Angeles River, as they might have done in the past, the city is going to take that water and put it into the storage pond, and then gradually over the next 6 or 7 months, they hope to pass it through a constructed wetland seen in the middle of the figure, and then recharge it into the aquifer. And this will produce about 600 acre feet, or if you average it out over the course of a year, about a 500,000 gallon of water a day. And so the city has plans to build runoff capture and recharge facilities like this throughout the San Fernando Valley where these contaminated waste sites are. So we're already starting to worry in some of our research about some of the contaminants that are present in urban runoff, and I've shown you a few examples of chemicals that are either associated with consumer products like Diuron, the herbicide, which is commonly used in right-of-ways, or the perfluorinated compounds like PFOA and PFOS, which we find in runoff and industrial sites, the mercaptobenzothiazoles, which we find coming off of roads because of all the tires, and even things like fipronil, this insecticide, which is used for structural pest control and used on people's dogs and cats. And so on the one hand, we've been spending a lot of time in the RenewIt program thinking about what could be an urban runoff, but we're also starting to think more and more now about how once we start recharging aquifers with this urban runoff, we might start mobilizing some of the legacy contamination from the Superfund sites and little pockets of contaminants that haven't been remediated yet. So there's certainly a clear connection between our efforts to enhance our water supply with urban runoff and these legacy hazardous waste sites that haven't been fully remediated, even decades after we started the Superfund program. The second area where this new approach for providing water supply might run into some of the problems associated with hazardous waste is water reuse and recycling. So many of you probably heard about the way in which we've been pursuing water reuse in California. In the last 5 to 10 years, we've moved away from the idea of using recycled water for industry and landscaping and golf courses to putting that recycled water directly into our drinking water supplies, because that's where it has the greatest value. And so the movement towards potable water recycling or potable water reuse has been made possible through the development of reverse osmosis membranes and advanced oxidation processes like the UV peroxide process shown here. So this schematic just gives you an idea of the way in which modern California water recycling is done. The municipal wastewater comes out of the sewage treatment plant. It's put through microfiltration to remove large particles. The water goes through reverse osmosis, which is very good at removing high molecular weight compounds and charged compounds because of its high selectivity. After reverse osmosis, you generate hydroxyl radicals in the advanced oxidation process, and then this water is put back into the water supply. And really, people think about the granddaddy of them all in terms of potable water reuse as being something called Water Factory 21, which is a project that the Orange County Water District started in the 1970s, where they used this advanced treatment technology to provide water for the Talbot Barrier, which was a seawater intrusion barrier, which was meant to protect the local groundwater supply from seawater that was coming in because of over-extraction of groundwater along the coast. And so in those initial years, there was about a cubic meter per second going in there, or 23 million gallons a day. And that water has been going in there for about 40 years now, and not only has it kept the seawater out, but it's also served to recharge the aquifers, because as the hydrogeologists in the audience know, the water flows both ways. It flows out towards the sea and back towards the drinking water users. This project has been so effective for Orange County that they knocked the Water Factory 21 down and in 2008 rechristened it as the Groundwater Replenishment System and tripled its size. And now they not only use that water for the Talbot Barrier, but they send some of it up to a recharge zone in the groundwater basin at Anaheim Lakes in the Warner Basin, and they use that to put in a total of something like 45 million gallons a day of water. So it's a critical part of Orange County's drinking water supply. So with the success of potable water reuse in Orange County, many communities around California are now thinking more seriously about building their own potable water recycling systems. But many of those communities lack a very nice groundwater aquifer underneath their city. And so the discussion that we're seeing now, not only in California, but in much of the rest of the West, is to consider the idea of direct potable reuse, this idea of taking wastewater from a treatment plant, putting it through an advanced treatment process in a water purification plant, and then either putting it into the front end of a drinking water treatment plant or putting it directly into the water distribution system. And there's currently a plan for building a project like this in El Paso. It'll probably be built in the next couple of years. And the city of San Diego and Santa Clara Valley in the South Bay here in the Bay Area are also contemplating direct potable reuse in the future. And so when we think about the idea of using wastewater as a drinking water supply, in the RENEWIT program and lots of other investigators around the country, we've been looking at the chemicals that might be present in the wastewater. And one of the things that I find quite worrisome is the phenomenon that I refer to as the Carlin effect. So I think that some of you on the call might remember the comedian and social critic George Carlin. And one of the things he once said was, somewhere in the world is the world's worst doctor. And what's truly terrifying is that someone has an appointment with him tomorrow morning. Well, somewhere in the country is the world's worst wastewater treatment plant. And next year, someone may propose to build a potable water recycling plant and connect up to that treatment plant. And that's the kind of thing that keeps me awake at night. And so if you think about this idea of the Carlin effect, we can see evidence that not all wastewater treatment plants are created equally. For example, the top figure shows you some data that we collected on NDMA, nitrosodimethylamine, this potent carcinogen that we sometimes see in wastewater. And some of the cities that we sampled had much higher concentration of NDMA in the incoming wastewater because they received effluent from printed circuit board manufacturers and other sources of industrial NDMA. Or the bottom left, which shows you some data on PFAS in sewage sludge from some treatment plants in Switzerland. The two on the left, which had concentrations that were over an order of magnitude higher than the average, were communities that had a lot of industry. Or on the bottom right-hand side, you can see some data from the USGS showing you that when they sampled and tried to measure opioid pharmaceuticals in communities where the pharmaceuticals were manufactured, the concentrations were close to 2 to 3 orders of magnitude higher than what they saw in the rest of the country. Another example of the kinds of things that I worry about when we think about potable water recycling are industrial sources of disinfection byproducts. This particular figure shows you some data from Japan where there was a wastewater treatment plant that received a small fraction of its effluent from a plastics manufacturer. And that plastics manufacturer released this compound here, HDMS, you see on the bottom, which is an anti-yellowing agent. And when that anti-yellowing agent was treated by ozone in the drinking water treatment plant, it made very high concentrations of NDMA. So the downstream users were seeing high concentrations of NDMA because an upstream user had been using this chemical, which was converted to NDMA during the drinking water treatment process. Another example of the kinds of things we're worried about in direct potable reuse programs is shown here. This is a figure from that Orange County advanced treatment plant that I showed you in an earlier slide. And at that treatment plant, they measure total organic carbon with an online analyzer before and after reverse osmosis. So the orange trace shows you before reverse osmosis, and the blue shows you after. And you can see that in the year 2013, in February, they had a half a day where they saw concentrations of organic chemicals breaking through the RO membrane at about 5 parts per million or milligrams per liter. When they sampled, it turned out that that pulse was due to acetone. So someone had poured a large slug of acetone down the sewer, and it had made it through the conventional wastewater treatment plant and the reverse osmosis membranes. Some of it was destroyed in the subsequent advanced oxidation process, and when this was recharged to the aquifer, the peak was probably attenuated by spreading in the groundwater basin. But if this had been a direct potable reuse project, this really could have been a problem. Finally, to turn our attention to seawater desalination, you know, it's not that with seawater desalination we're worried about, oh, I don't know, hazardous waste in the ocean where someone's drawing the seawater. What interests me about the relationship between seawater desalination and the Superfund program is we're starting to build large, full-scale desalination plants in California and Australia and Israel. And as we do, we drive down the cost of this technology. So this photo here shows you the desalination plant, which is opening now in Carlsbad, California, just north of San Diego. It'll be the largest desalination plant in the Western Hemisphere, and it uses the reverse osmosis technology that I told you about, that the same technology that's used for water recycling. Now, when I learned about reverse osmosis, I'd always been told that it was not a very practical technology for treating large amounts of water because it used so much energy. But this figure shows you the way in which power consumption for running a reverse osmosis treatment plant has come down in the last 40 years. So you can see that from the inset that even between the year 2000 and 2008, we've reduced the energy use in RO by about half, and it's approaching that dotted line there, which is the theoretical maximum. And so what this means to us is that reverse osmosis might start to become a technology that we turn to at hazardous waste sites. Perhaps someday it'll become competitive with activated carbon and other technologies that we use for pump and treat technologies. But you can see from this water revolution, there are going to be technology transfer in both directions. And I think this is particularly relevant because the idea that Bill mentioned earlier, this White House meeting on water innovation, does have the potential to advance some of these technologies. So this is a figure that came out of that meeting last December where the White House was talking about its goal of reducing the cost of seawater desalination from $2 a cubic meter to 50 cents a cubic meter through a variety of targeted R&D efforts, which would look at all aspects of the RO treatment process, not just the development of membranes, but the energy efficiency and the design of the technologies. And these kinds of economies of scale that come from research and the formation of a new industry can have spillover effects. And I think the spillover effect that I find interesting for hazardous waste remediation is that these might also find applications to site cleanup. So some final thoughts. I told you briefly in this high-level overview that many parts of the country are thinking about the need for a water supply revolution and that these water supply revolutions have a relationship to hazardous waste and the Superfund program. I showed you that we're increasingly looking towards our urban aquifers as drinking water sources, which means that we really need to redouble our efforts to remediate and protect urban aquifer. And we also have to think about the fact that when we start recharging these aquifers with runoff, we might be introducing new contaminants or mobilizing legacy contaminants. I told you about how increasingly water reuse is turning towards potable water reuse, and that we need to be especially careful about those compounds that can break through reverse osmosis membranes. I gave you the example of acetone today, but there are plenty of low molecular weight neutral compounds that are present in our wastewater, and especially from industrial sources. And so we really have to be careful about the industrial pretreatment programs, which we've tended to ignore. And then I told you about the rapid developments in desalination technologies and how they might actually eventually play a role in treatment of hazardous waste and groundwater at Superfund sites. And so looking forward, I think there's a lot of research that still needs to be done. I think that we, like I said, I think we really need to redouble our efforts in groundwater treatment technologies, especially in urban aquifers that we may be turning to increasingly as water supply. I think we have to think a little bit harder about identifying contaminant sources. I gave you a few examples of how just looking in municipal wastewater effluent, we can find contaminants of public health relevance, and it's not always obvious, for example, in the case of that anti-yellowing agent that was converted to nitrosamines, that there are things that are going to show up on lists of monitoring chemicals. And I think that increasingly, as we turn to these new sources of water, we need to partner with our public health colleagues to understand the possibility that we could be having unexpected effects on human health as we look towards some of these novel water supplies. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Heather. Thank you.
Thank you, David. This is a great start for this seminar series. You're talking about the new technologies that are needed, new technologies that might be adapted, in fact, for groundwater remediation and drinking and useful for drinking water, and then also pointed towards issues that may again mean that we need to watch out for these hazardous substances in the environment when we start to consider these water reuse and new urban approaches to water management. So thank you very much for introducing the topic. We did have a few questions come in, so I'll go ahead and start with the online questions. And earlier there was a comment, just for clarification, you had talked about the Rory Shaw Wetland Project. And just if you could reiterate what the cost was approximately for that project, and if you could also repeat how many millions of gallons per day they would produce and
sure.
Or use.
Sure. So the Rory M. Shaw Wetland Project is I think the data that I seem to recall is that it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million, but a lot of that was for acquiring the land. And the estimates are that, on average, it will capture about 600 acre-feet per year. And if you're more comfortable with million gallons a day, if you average it out, which it, obviously the rain only falls on a few days of the year, but if you average it out, it works out to about 500,000 gallons a day.
Okay, that's what I believe that was what was captured. So thanks very much for answering that. Another question came, how do you see the role of drinking water monitoring in the water supply revolution concept, and who should do it?
Oh, gee, well, we have a robust system of drinking water monitoring when it's properly implemented. So the Safe Drinking Water Act and drinking water utilities have primary responsibility for monitoring what's delivered to the taps of consumers. And I think we just need to redouble our efforts and remember that we don't always have MCLs for all the contaminants that might make a difference. So, I think as we pursue this revolution, the country would be well-informed to follow the lead that California is showing of starting to look for some of the unregulated contaminants and not waiting exclusively for the EPA's CCL3 process to identify new contaminants of concern. Because you have to remember that the process through which we identify contaminants of concern at the federal level thinks about the whole nation and all the exposure that could happen. And as we think about local and regional issues, as we think about stormwater capture and water recycling, and as we think about the industrial users within a sewer shed or a watershed, we need to be a little bit more targeted. And so I think that the water treatment facilities should still be primarily responsible for that monitoring, but I think that our list of contaminants that we monitor should probably be expanded.
Thank you. Another question, what near-term areas of reverse osmosis development are most needed to enable its use for wastewater purification processes?
Essentially it's a mature technology. The the use of reverse osmosis for water recycling is something that, you know, we've developed the thin film composite membrane and other kinds of treatment technologies, and we're able to do this at scale and in an economically efficient way. So there may be opportunities for development of novel kinds of membranes, things like graphene oxides and carbon nanotubes, but they're not going to really change the landscape. The price might come down a little bit. The cost of materials might come down. The energy might become more efficient. But essentially, it's good to go.
Okay, thank you. Another comment. We are working on a Superfund site in Region 2, pulling 69 million gallons a day from our study area, where numerous urban sources have contaminated water supply. So this person is happy to share what they've found and the impact of recharge and drawdown from major pumpage.
And great.
And they're using environmental forensic methods to identify the CVOC sources. So that was a comment.
Interesting. Yeah, no, definitely an area where we need more more technology and advances, and where the tremendous innovations in mass spectrometry are allowing us to discover contaminants much more quickly and efficiently than we were in the past.
Definitely, and pointing out the sources too, the environmental forensics can be so important for that. Another question, a curiosity, is to know how they are going to catch and gather rainwater in the urban areas to convey to the storage ponds. I guess this is...
So in the case of the Rory Shaw Wetland Park, it's actually a neighborhood that doesn't yet have storm sewers, because it was an area of the basin that was very, very permeable. And so the developers, when they originally developed the area, decades ago, thought that all the rain would just percolate into the ground through the sandy sediments. But as more and more paving has happened, they're experiencing urban flooding. And so the city is in the process of building the first generation of storm sewers in part of that neighborhood. And when you're building it the first time, it's easy to convey them to the capture pond. And so it'll be completely by gravity, and it'll be a conventional storm sewer system, much like the ponds and sumps that people are familiar with in the East Coast that often are capturing rainwater.
Okay, great. I believe that answered the question. What methods and technologies were applied? They had a follow-up clarification for their question, but I certainly believe you answered it there. At this point, we can open up the phone lines and see if there are any of our callers who would like to ask a question to David. If you would, what you need to do first is press the pound and six, and that will unmute your line, and then you can ask your question. And we also invite our co-presenters to do that, too, if they had questions. This is all open discussion time. Okay, not hearing any questions at this time. David, maybe we'd like to thank you for your excellent presentation. When you present such a clear and well-outlined talk like that, maybe you just don't have a lot of questions for follow-up, but certainly really appreciate your insights there. There will be time after our next presenters to ask additional questions for David, and again, we invite you to submit those questions at any time. So again, thank you, David, for your presentation on the water supply and giving us an idea of how things are happening out on the West Coast. And our next speakers, and we can pull up those slides, are going to give us a little idea of how things are happening on the East Coast. And these presenters will be Wendy Higer-Bernays and Madeline Scammell, and they're both from the Boston University Superfund Research Program. They're going to be talking about 1,4-dioxane in Massachusetts, a case study. Let me introduce our speakers today. Wendy is an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University School of Public Health. Her work reflects her education in molecular toxicology and her professional experience in regulatory toxicology and risk assessment. Her interests center on understanding how environmental hazards adversely affect people's health and how risks associated with these exposures can be quantified and decreased. As leader of the Research Translation Corps, the Boston University Superfund Research Program, she works with the scientific project leads and regulatory, environmental, and health organizations and uses the science to inform policy and practice. She is currently an American Association for Advancement of Science, AAAS, Science and Technology Fellow, where she is hosted in the EPA, Office of Science and Coordination and Policy. She's using high-throughput toxicological data to identify chemicals in water that have endocrine bioactivity. Our other speaker today, who will be tag-team presenting with Wendy, Madeline Scammell. She's an assistant professor of environmental health at Boston University School of Public Health, and she serves as leader of the Boston University Superfund Research Program Community Engagement Corps. Her experience is in the area of community-driven and community-based participatory research and includes the use of qualitative methods in environmental health and epidemiological studies. Her particular interest is in the combined effects of social and environmental stressors. She is also a JPB Environmental Health Fellow at T.H. Kahn, Harvard School of Public Health. So I don't know who is kicking this off, but Wendy and Madeline, I turn it over to you.
All right, thank you. You can hear me?
Yes, you sound great.
Okay, great. Thank you. This is Wendy. Thank you to NIEHS and for the SRP staff and to the listeners on this call for the opportunity to share some recent work that we've been able to do as part of our Superfund research program. We think that several of the elements of this case are relevant to communities well beyond Massachusetts. And I want to thank David for really setting us up well. As he pointed out, at some point the engineers should be talking to their public health colleagues. I think that's Madeline and I. So this is a really good sort of segue. A little bit very briefly about the Boston University Superfund Research Program is that we focus on developmental and reproductive effects of Superfund chemicals, and our program includes 5 research projects and 4 core facilities, including the Community Engagement and Research Translation Corps. As Heather mentioned, I'm the lead of the Research Translation Corps, and the Research Translation Corps is a required corps, as Bill stated earlier. It provides a mechanism to allow the research findings to reach stakeholders, all stakeholders, who can use the information for multiple purposes, including decision-making, and that can be decision-making at multiple levels, including the communities with whom we work. While the 4 specific aims that are listed here are somewhat generic, this case study actually illustrates 3 of the 4 aims, including close coordination of the Research Translation Corps with the Community Engagement Corps.
And that's me. This is Madeline. Thanks, Wendy. The specific aims of the Community Engagement Corps are on your slide, and I want to emphasize the first, providing scientific expertise in response to community questions. And this is really where we listen a lot to community groups around the state of Massachusetts and New England about what their environmental health concerns are and how our research can be responsive to those questions and concerns. And we've focused in particular on boards of health in Massachusetts, which I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, but Massachusetts is unique, and we have a health department or a health agent, a health officer in every one of our 351 municipalities, our cities and towns, and often volunteer boards of health with quite a bit of authority and responsibility for protecting the public health of the towns and cities. So we work quite a bit with members of boards of health to help them be responsive, identify issues in their communities and access the greatest and latest scientific information. And Wendy and I both serve on our local boards of health. So the next slide. This is a map of Massachusetts. And I want to point out, and I will with my pointer here, the lower right corner, this whole landmass here is known as Cape Cod. It's a popular tourist destination. It's separated by the mainland by a man-made canal. And this whole area is considered a sole source aquifer. So that was designated by EPA, I think, in 1982 by Ann Gorsuch. If it were to be contaminated, there is no other alternative. It is a fragile ecosystem. Cape it is. This next slide shows you the town of Eastham, which is about halfway up on the forearm of Cape Cod, if you imagine it as an arm, just above the elbow. You'll notice it's surrounded by water. It's 6 miles long, 3 miles wide, one big road, Route 6. Saltwater intrusion is definitely a concern. There are kettle ponds, glacial kettle ponds, and a pretty high water table. So I want to point out on the map, oh, I love this pointer. Right here, you can see this area of land. That is the Eastham landfill. It is capped. It is now basically a transfer station. But that is a player in the story we're going to tell about 1,4-dioxane contamination. I should say that Eastham, the town of Eastham, which is all right here, is the last municipality on the Cape to not have a municipal water supply. Everyone who lives there or rents there for any period of the year is reliant on private drinking water wells and septic systems. So next slide, regular groundwater well monitoring around the landfill for a variety of biological and chemical contaminants, including unregulated contaminants, identified 1,4-dioxane. And subsequent monitoring in areas thought to be in the plume of the landfill groundwater, we're also detecting 1,4-dioxane above drinking water guidelines established by the EPA. So our Superfund research program, Wendy and I, were contacted by a concerned resident, by the health director in the town of Eastham, and by MassDEP within 2 days of each other. Wendy and I both said, hey, we've got to talk to you about something. And there began our journey. Wendy, yeah, there we go.
Okay, sorry. So thank you, Madeline. In the Eastham case, there were multiple regulatory authorities involved in an investigation and involved in this case. This made for a somewhat complicated situation. And I point out that the residents throughout all of this had different levels of trust regarding the different authorities. So as Madeline described, the town of Eastham is both the owner of the landfill, it's a municipal landfill, and responsible at the same time for protection of health of the community via the Board of Health. Secondly, there's MassDEP was involved because of the contamination of the water supply, the oversight of the solid waste landfill, and the release of hazardous chemicals from that landfill. And these three, I'm using my pointer here, these three bureaus also needed to work together, even though in some instances the three bureaus of MassDEP have slightly different interpretations of the response to the measured concentrations of 1,4-dioxane in the water. And lastly, EPA Region 1 was also involved. EPA Region 1 provided personnel to collect samples from the private drinking water wells and conducted the analyses of those samples in the Region 1 laboratory. And just point out that the analyses were paid for by the town. On the next slide, I have to mention, of course, that we haven't yet described to you what 1,4-dioxane is. And this slide is a screenshot of the fact sheet that we compiled, that our group compiled and provided to the residents and all of the parties that were described on the previous slide. It provides information on the major sources of 1,4-dioxane, which is a small organic molecule that is very water soluble that moves rapidly from the soils to the water. 1,4-dioxane is a chemical that's used in the manufacture of many products, including paint strippers, varnishes, but also consumer products, namely shampoos, deodorants, and pharmaceuticals. It's actually used in a process to make the cleansing agents in those shampoos and deodorants less abrasive, and it actually offers some enhanced foaming characteristics, which is what we want from our soaps. So in other words, consumer products are a major source of 1,4-dioxane. But the presence of it in the municipal landfill, I guess, is not so surprising because of what we tend to put in our garbage. Nor is it surprising to find it, actually, in septic systems. And you'll remember that Madeline pointed out that Eastham did not have a municipal water supply, and everyone relied on private wells. They also are dependent on on-site wastewater or septic systems. Now, what do we know about the health effects of 1,4-dioxane? Well, most of what we know are based on animal studies in which 1,4-dioxane has been identified by EPA and by IARC as a likely human carcinogen. It also causes liver and kidney damage. And another set of studies suggest developmental effects in offspring of rats exposed to 1,4-dioxane in utero. And on the next slide, we asked, so that's some of the information about what 1,4-dioxane is and why we might be concerned about it. But we also have to look at whether it's present in water. How common is 1,4-dioxane in groundwater? The information on this slide is actually taken from a presentation given by MassDEP at an organization meeting of the Northeast Waste Management Officials Association meeting. And on this slide, we see occurrences of 1,4-dioxane measured in groundwater. These are identified by the stars and the pushpins on the map of Massachusetts. And note that 1,4-dioxane shows up across the state and not just in Eastham out here on the Cape. My pointer doesn't work very well, so I'm sorry. Oh, there it is. And not just out here on the Cape. It's important to note that the reporting limit for measuring the chemical is very low. And that means that when we look in groundwater that's potentially impacted by waste, it actually will be detected. So Massachusetts didn't actually take this task on to go ahead and look for 1,4-dioxane. It was actually prompted and is part of a program from EPA. And the 1,4-dioxane is a chemical for which there is no federal drinking water standard. It was included on the list of unregulated contaminants that are known to or perhaps anticipated to occur in water systems and may require regulation later on at some point under the Safe Drinking Water Act that David referred to. But in order to get a better picture of its actual occurrence, the rule called the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule requires the measurement of this shorter list of chemicals, including 1,4-dioxane, in public water supplies across the U.S. So 1,4-dioxane is measured. You saw that on the previous slide. And I'll just point out that while we're focused on 1,4-dioxane, but as David mentioned and pointed out, there are many contaminants that are not regulated, and there are many contaminants that actually don't fall under this unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, but are being measured and remain unregulated. So how is 1,4-dioxane regulated? And this slide points out, again, of course there is no water standard, but there is information. We have health research data that I spoke about, the UCMR data, and there is some information about treatment technologies. Now, removal of 1,4-dioxane from water is very difficult. And in order for drinking water standard to be implemented, there really needs to be a way to provide people with water that doesn't contain the regulated chemical. However, there is a drinking water guideline that's based on the science of 1,4-dioxane's toxicity and its presence in groundwater. This value, the one we're speaking about, was developed by MassDEP and is based on protecting people's health in that it is developed to be health protective, and it is intended to serve as a guide, hence the name guideline. So it's intended to serve as a guide to guide a process, and that process is really the investigation of the 1,4-dioxane and action to be taken if the concentrations are at or around the guideline. But I'll point out that it wasn't intended, it's not intended to be used as a strict drinking water standard. So here's where it's complicated in Eastham. The guideline was intended to be used to determine initially if the landfill was the source of 1,4-dioxane in the wells in which it was measured. And if so, then the action needed to be taken, in this case, to provide provide bottled water. Now, for us, the difficulty comes in the risk communication regarding the difference between a guideline and a standard, and interpretation of these two terms, since the health research data that go into this are essentially identical. So I also want to point out, and Madeline will speak to the process that we went through, but I also want to point out that the Board of Health in Eastham has been collecting nitrate data from the wells, the drinking water wells, from a large percentage of the drinking water wells for quite some time. And the nitrate data are often used as an indicator of impact or contamination by septic systems. So in addition to measuring the very low concentrations of 1,4-dioxane, we're also had some data looking at the nitrate concentrations that are often used as indicators of septic impacts.
Okay, thanks. So this is Madeline again, and as you can imagine, so as Wendy said, the town had been collecting data from private well owners on their nitrate levels for many years, and it was becoming apparent to everyone that there was intrusion of septic systems into drinking water wells. And these are signs here that show different opinions on the question of whether or not to invest in a municipal water supply for the town. So on the left is vote no to a $114 million project, and on the right is vote yes at the NASA Regional High School gym. So this was coming out about the 1,4-dioxane at a particularly challenging and contentious time for many residents who felt strongly they did or did not want to have a municipal water supply. And you may imagine also, maybe you've had experience with this, people, private well water owners who were not terribly concerned about nitrates, did not have their private drinking water wells tested for many years, didn't want the government coming and telling them they had to test. And we're of the opinion that if 1,4-dioxane is so bad for me, how come EPA is not regulating it? Why is the town interfering? Why do you think it's so bad? EPA doesn't regulate it. It must not be a problem. So that was sort of the setting for our engagement. And I think it really helped in some ways. Others could speak better to this, but that we were a third party, that we were not a regulator. We didn't have a stake in the outcome. We were at Boston University, 100 miles away. But what did we do? We talked to residents over the phone. We took a lot of phone calls. We met with the health agent several times. We went out with the licensed site professional, the privately contracted company who was working with the state and the town to assess the situation, reviewed their sampling plan, made the fact sheet, and we participated in this public meeting, which is videotaped, and you can watch on the Town of East Ham's website. It says a toxicology report. It wasn't really a toxicology report, but Wendy is a toxicologist. And the next slide is actually from that presentation, and it was basically our attempt to give, in very clear terms, an overview of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And one of the challenges of having a national standard that EPA would set is the need for technology not just to monitor and detect chemicals, laboratories available in every town or state where water samples could be sent for testing, but also for treating. And until it's possible to treat 1,4-dioxane in every municipality across the country or every public water supply, it is not feasible for EPA to set a standard. So it really has not as much to do with health as people might like to believe. We pointed out that there are just over 90 regulated contaminants right now regulated by EPA and over 100 on the candidate list for regulation, known many of them to have health concerns, 1,4-dioxane being one of them. So this is what we presented, also iterating, as it says at the end, that this law only applies to public water supplies, and the town of East Ham really did yeoman's work. They actually got samples for nitrates from every single home in the town of East Ham, which was remarkable in the end. But then also giving props to our state of Massachusetts that under the Safe Drinking Water Act, it is okay for states to have more protective regulations for more contaminants, and that the guideline was a step in that direction. So how did the 1,4-dioxane situation on the Cape end? This just came out a few weeks ago, this article by researchers at Silent Spring Institute, also in Massachusetts, who have been studying Cape Cod water challenges for almost two decades or more. And the septic system intrusion in domestic drinking water wells is a real problem, not just in East Ham, but across the Cape and in many places like it. So I'm going to skip to the next slide to say, in the end, the town did vote for a municipal water supply after a few votes. And these are some residents having a celebration next to the first fire hydrant in their town. And hurdle for the town, I guess you might say, is a wastewater treatment system or some way to manage waste at the municipal level. But the water supply is in construction and due to open, I think, in fall of 2016. So the next slide was just last week's news. A little bit about risk communication. This is from the Worcester Telegram, also in Massachusetts. Another landfill, another detection of 1,4-dioxane. I heard about this by listening to the news on the radio and couldn't help but notice the reporter talking about 1,4-dioxin. And we encountered a lot of residents who were really concerned about dioxin, had heard it's one of the most poisonous compounds on the planet, and is this what is in our water? So this is a really big issue in Massachusetts now, along with perfluorinated compounds. In the next slide, I just really want to thank our colleagues in the town of Eastham, James Crowley in particular, at MassDEP, former student Ashley Miller, and our colleague Veronica Vera, who was wanting to work with us on spatial analyses. She did actually provide input on spatial analyses of the groundwater plume. And Wendy, is there any last thing you want to say?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you all. And Dr. Sedlak, I think that George Carlin would be proud. That's my last comment.
I agree. Thank you, Madeline, and thank you, Wendy, for your presentation. At this time, we can open it up for questions for our presenters. And to do that, just type your question into the question and answer box, and I'll read off your questions. In a minute, we'll open up the phone lines. So if you're on the phone, be thinking about your questions, and we'll give you a chance to ask them. Let's start with one from our online participant. Question came, what treatment system did the town use? So assuming that the wells had 1,4-dioxane too.
Wendy can chime in, but I would just say they've identified a well for their municipal water source that at this point does not have 1,4-dioxane contamination. And there has not been identified a reliable treatment technology at this point, to my knowledge.
Okay, that makes sense.
Could I chime in here? This is David.
Sure, David.
We've run into 1,4-dioxane in California in some of the potable water recycling programs, and the UV peroxide process that's used in these treatment plants does destroy the 1,4-dioxane and allows cost-effective removal.
And just for clarification again, we're talking about 1,4-dioxane, not to be confused with dioxins.
That's correct. In our case, the 1,4-dioxane, it came from, ironically enough, one of the main sources was a manufacturer. I believe it was someone who was manufacturing treatment membranes, as well as I think some carpet manufacturers as well. But there were industrial sources to the sewer of the solvent 1,4-dioxane.
1,4-dioxane, right. And then just out of curiosity, are there is there such thing as congener of 1,4-dioxane?
No.
Okay.
Nope. So the molecule is just a cyclical molecule with two oxygens in the circle.
So no congeners. This is not a dioxin. It's a different.
Right. Different beast.
Yeah, right. Okay. Great. Thanks for that clarification. So MassDEP, what is their 1,4-dioxane groundwater standard, if they have one?
As I mentioned, there is no groundwater standard. There is the guideline, and the guideline is I believe it's 0.35 micrograms per liter. Is that what
you said? What?
Question, I think.
0.35.
Actually, it's 0.3. They round. They use a single significant digit, so it's 0.3 micrograms per liter.
Gotcha. Related to that thought, question came in. There's lots of varied thinking on an appropriate human health level for 1,4-dioxane, especially in New Jersey. Proposed standard, similarly, is 0.3 micrograms per liter, and many risk experts are suggesting a standard around 250 micrograms per liter. Any thoughts?
You mean based on the underlying toxicology? Is that the question? I think it probably
right.
is.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there has been some, right. There was a paper that was published by Darrison and group raising questions about the use of the underlying data for the derivation of that lower concentration. And no, I haven't looked more closely at it.
Okay, thanks for that. Is MassDEP aware of EPA's new IRIS assessment? Has MassDEP decided to use that document, or do they have reasons for deciding that it's not appropriate?
Well, I don't think that I'm able to speak for MassDEP.
It was the wording of the question, but I guess, you know, was there an awareness of the new IRIS assessment?
Yes, I'm sure that there was, but I do want to remind us that the guideline that was developed was in fact based on a 10 to the minus 6 risk level. And so the unit risks that are derived in the IRIS file, I believe, are based on the same underlying science, but the assumptions about what we'll call acceptable risks are different.
Okay.
So again, it goes to what the purpose of the number is. It was used as something to initiate a process to find out more information about the source of the 1,4-dioxane, who might be exposed, and how they were exposed, and then to take action accordingly.
Okay. And we've had several people weighing in for clarification, too, about the cleanup levels and that saying that the MassDEP Bureau of Waste Site Cleanup has a soil and groundwater cleanup standard for 1,4-dioxane of 0.2 milligrams per kilogram and 0.3 micrograms per liter, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's
not a question. That's a statement, right?
That was a clarification that came in perhaps from somebody from MassDEP, but I'm not quite sure of their affiliation.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. And then a question came up, what is the population of East Ham? How far is the landfill from the majority of private wells that were impacted? This person knows of a Superfund site in New Hampshire that has recently contaminated private wells.
I don't know the population of East Ham, but it really it changes quite a bit from winter to summer, off, of course, in the summer. And there's a highway on one edge of the landfill and residents more or less on the other side of the fence from the landfill. Pretty close. I couldn't tell you in feet or meters how close their well water is.
Okay, so go ahead.
The population is, as Madeline mentioned, it almost triples in the summertime, and it's about 5,000 to 6,000 year-round, permanent residents, and then increases in the summer when people come to vacation.
This is another community that is potentially facing the same situation that you walked through with East Ham. This was also a landfill site. So what advice would you give to somebody in that community for making decisions, or what would you say about this case study that was very successful and you think should be repeated?
I don't know anything about the New Hampshire site, but I will say this has been happening all over. I mean, every time we turn around, it seems like someone's discovered 1,4-dioxane. And I'm not sure that the source, I don't know that for certain the source is the Superfund site or the landfill. In this case, it turns out it's probably the septic systems, but all eyes were focused on the landfill because that seemed to make sense. But I think the biggest issue is what is the water source and the water supply and how is it being treated. And I do remember there were a lot of attempts to find a an on-site water treatment system for residents who have 1,4-dioxane contamination but don't want to stop using their private drinking water supply. And that, I think, was very experimental.
And then just again, for more details about how the process went, would that be in your Science of the Total Environment publication? Kind of walking through the situation and the site and the engagement?
We have not written this up yet.
Okay.
I think you're thinking about the vapor intrusion.
Right. Well, so I was getting a lot of specific questions about the site, and maybe we can just connect you, if that's all right, offline, so that you can field those questions or maybe help
to
make connections between one site and the one that you worked with.
Okay.
Great. And again, clarification came in. The population of East Ham is about 6,000. It increases to 30,000 in the summer months, and most lots were half-acre lots there. Here's a question that came up that relates to David's comment about the treatment process, and so maybe we can just open up the phone lines to both speakers at this point. David, you mentioned that UV peroxide can be used for 1,4-dioxane, and this person asks, what levels, to what level can that treatment work?
Oh, gee, if I recall, they were seeing concentrations in the tens of micrograms per liter, and they were getting more than 90 or 95% removal on it, but I'd have to dig into it a little bit. But in general, the advanced treatment plants in California are being designed with 1,4-dioxane as a test compound to verify their performance. So the UV peroxide process is being very well studied for 1,4-dioxane removal, and it serves as a benchmark to know that the advanced oxidation process is functioning properly. So if I recall, most of those systems are getting at least 90% removal, and you just need to increase the amount of light and the peroxide concentration if you wanted greater removals.
Okay, great. That's certainly a ballpark. And if it's off the top of your head, that's really good. I'm sorry to put you on the spot there. There was a question actually that came in earlier, David, during your talk, but I think it has a lot of relevance too to what Wendy and Madeline were just speaking about. This was with regard to whose job it is for monitoring, and the comment was, there is a robust monitoring system within waterworks facilities. However, in some instances, public confidence has been broken. And so the questioner is asking where third-party independent monitoring would fit in, in situations like that, and your thoughts about that, David, and Wendy and Madeline, if you'd like to weigh in on that as well.
Well, I do agree that when outside third parties come in, especially if they're seen as not having an axe to grind, they can be considered more reputable and dependable. And so in some of these projects on so-called emerging contaminants in these new water supplies, academic researchers have been valuable to the process. But in some cases, state health labs. So here in California, we have the Department of Public Health that was instrumental in uncovering the perchlorate and NDMA and 1,4-dioxane contamination issues here, and they did that above and beyond what the drinking water suppliers were meant to be obtaining. So I think sometimes it's outside academic researchers, and sometimes it's state health departments. And in a few cases, there have been non-governmental organizations, for example, that that paper that was shown on the DEP, on the Cape Cod site was from the Silent Spring Institute, and they initiated the sampling on their own as well. So these outside groups can be good, especially when there's not a routine monitoring requirement, but I don't think that they should replace or supersede the normal compliance monitoring and annual reporting that goes out to consumers.
Gotcha. Wendy or Madeline, did you have any thoughts on that?
No, I would agree with that, but I think the place for alternative testing or other groups perhaps is really in identifying some of the chemicals or the other agents that are not currently required to be monitored for. And I think that it's that body of knowledge that is useful in driving, ultimately driving regulation. So I think, as David points out, that the required monitoring under the Safe Drinking Water Act for the chemicals that we look for should, you know, I know that there has been great angst, and rightfully so, about not doing it properly. But I think, in general, our water supplies are properly monitored or should continue to be monitored. I think that we need to be strong advocates for continuing that monitoring and looking at the data. But I also think that we raised an issue here, which is that issue of the private drinking water wells, right, which are not covered by the monitoring that's required under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And I think that that's an important issue, and not to lose it. And the states do have the ability to make rules about their private drinking water supplies. And in fact, in Massachusetts, the local boards of health actually have the authority to require different levels of testing. Again, but we're battling the cost issue. You know, what do you look for? And I think on the Cape, the looking at the nitrate is a really valuable pieces of data to collect. Inexpensive, done locally, but indicate perhaps upgradient contamination.
Great, excellent thoughts there. It is more complicated than one would do, certainly. The question came, is there any evidence or indication that industry could remove this from their products? And I believe 1,4-dioxane is what was referred to here.
Well, I think we can look to Johnson & Johnson that removed 1,4-dioxane from their baby shampoo. And I won't speak to rationale or anything else, but I think we always have to be a little bit careful when we substitute, because we want to know what we're substituting for, because there are often unintended consequences. But to answer that question directly, yes, there have been industry, there have been products for which 1,4-dioxane has been removed. And I think there was an environmental working group program several years ago that identified those products, including dish detergent and clothing detergent, that had fairly substantial levels of 1,4-dioxane. And I think in response to that awareness, some formulations were changed.
This is Madeline. I'll just say, talking with some of the residents about where the 1,4-dioxane may have come from, if it wasn't the landfill, it really was, a lesson in our chemicals policy. A lot of the chemicals in our consumer products are not okay for human health or the environment, and that's why they're being detected in groundwater at unsafe levels. And that came as a surprise to a lot of people.
Good point. We have another question online. After that, I'll open up the phone lines. So if you're on the phone, be thinking of your questions. During the treatment of sewage, I believe this is for David, during the treatment of sewage to be utilized as drinking water, are viruses being removed?
Oh, yeah. I didn't have a chance to mention it because it didn't seem as relevant for Superfund, but there are very strict requirements for removal of viruses, bacteria, and other waterborne pathogens. And, in fact, that drives a lot of the treatment technology. So the primary ways that they're removed are the conventional sewage treatment process, the reverse osmosis treatment, and the UV peroxide treatment, which also is germicidal. And increasingly with these direct potable reuse projects, we're also seeing the addition of an ozonation step as another barrier. So there are multiple barriers against viruses.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions from the phone lines? If so, all you have to do is press pound and 6, and that will take your phone off mute. And we'll give the phone participants just a little time to ask their question, if you have any. Okay, sounds like crickets. So we'll just move on. Another question did come on from online, and this is just if you could repeat maybe if you already presented it. The questioner wasn't sure, but where is EPA on setting a federal MCL for 1,4-dioxane?
This is Wendy. I cannot speak for EPA either. Again, setting the drinking water standard requires that there is the science and all of the other issues that go into setting the standard, and that includes the economics and the politics and all the other things. And so I cannot speak for EPA, but I suspect that with other contaminants such as perchlorate, like David had mentioned, the state of California went ahead and developed a standard. Massachusetts went ahead and developed a standard. And so we'll just leave 1,4-dioxane out there as well.
Great. Thanks for providing clarification on that. We'll wait for the time when it is released. Did any final thoughts, David or Wendy or Madeline or Dr. Sook, about your comments or the questions that came up, or any sage advice?
This is Bill. Bill Sook. I just want to thank the participants. I'd like to thank everybody on the phone, and I just want to reiterate the fact that this is obviously a very important subject, and we are holding additional webinars on this, and I hope everybody can attend. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Dr. Sook, and certainly on that note, we absolutely heard about how important it is to understand more of the toxicology. How there's still questions about detecting some of these contaminants in the environment, or how we can sample for them, clean them up, and then even while all of this engineering and health research is going on, how do we communicate that to the people who are going to be impacted? And that's what we plan to cover in the next upcoming webinars. And those of you who registered for this webinar, you'll get a notification of the next webinars as they come up. Through our Risky Learning mailing list, we're still getting a few questions coming in. One is, what about citizen science monitoring or participation with water quality?
This is Madeline. I think that's great. I think all efforts to engage residents, not necessarily citizens even, but people who drink water in learning about what the contaminants are and measuring them and understanding the meaning of those measurements to regulators and to themselves is really valuable. And as David said before, we do have pretty robust regulations, but they are not always equally enforced, and information is not always accessible to people who should have it. So I can't speak highly enough about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think we'll be hearing more about that when our community session comes up later on this summer. We hope people will stay tuned for that. Another question came in about forensic toxin identification. That comment came up earlier when Lisa Voice, had a question to David Sedlak. And so David, I'm not sure if you would know the answer to this question, but can you recommend effective analytical methods available in the U.S. for forensic toxin identification of untargeted analytes such as pharmaceuticals, pesticides, et cetera? This would be similar to the Thermo Fisher Scientific Variable Data Independent Acquisition, VDIA.
Yeah, so there are a number of emerging research topics where our ability to find these unidentified compounds is rapidly improving. We are definitely seeing rapid progress in the area of HPLC with different types of mass spectrometry, like Orbitrap mass spectrometry and high-resolution mass spectrometry. But I would caution people that those techniques are particularly good at finding high molecular weight and charged compounds. And most of the contaminants that we found are particularly problematic for human health tend to be neutral and are often hydrophobic. And so I think we do need to think more about things like gas chromatography with time-of-flight mass spectrometry and other kinds of GC technologies that I think people are not paying enough attention to these days. The other approach, of course, is to think about using some sort of bioassay or bioassay-directed fractionation. There's been some progress along those lines as well, but I'm not aware of any new contaminants that have been identified that way. So when I look back at these new generations of contaminants of human health concern and the ways in which they've been detected, oftentimes it's by accident. People stumble upon an unidentified peak or an unidentified finding and they dig into it. And other times it's with mass spectrometry. So I encourage people to keep their eyes on that and to follow the latest research developments.
Sounds like a great plan, and maybe we can end on that note. And I certainly want to thank all of our presenters, Dr. Sook, David Sedlak, Wendy Hager-Bernays, Madeline Scammell. Thanks so much for your presentations and sharing your presentations with us today. It really does set the stage for some of the big picture issues, whether we're talking about an urban watershed or well water, and whether it's the East Coast or the West Coast. There are different challenges on both sides and everywhere in between. There's a lot of regulations that protect us, and then some that surprisingly don't cover everything. So we do need to ask questions and follow the most up-to-date research, as Dr. Sedlak was saying. So we're going to go ahead and move towards concluding the webinar. But before we do, we wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod. This contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars on an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. In fact, those of you who did register, you will get an email letting you know that the archive is available. And we also encourage you to forward that to your colleagues who may be interested in today's webinar but who were unable to attend. So in addition, the related URLs pod, you will find a seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling this out. It's an online form, and we look at your comments, and it helps us to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Also, there are many ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any webinars. More information on EPA's CLUIN webinar, please refer to cluin.org website, the EPA cleanup. I'm going to see if I can use this arrow. Oh, maybe not. I'm having the same problem Wendy was, I think. Oh, there it goes. Oh, here. Okay, great. The EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. You can follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter. You can also join the Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. It's a LinkedIn group. And SRP has some web pages also. We have our Risky Learning webinar series, which is this current series. And again, if you visit that site, you'll be able to access some of the upcoming webinars. We also have a progress in research webinar page as well. We also have research briefs, and we have a Twitter page. And we encourage you, whatever your online vices are, we have something for you to stay connected. So please do so. and again, we certainly want to thank our presenters today, Bill Sook, David Sedlak, Wendy Heiger-Bernays, and Madeline Scammell. Thank you very much for these presentations. We also want to thank the folks at CLUIN, the Office of Land and Emergency Management, for letting us have our webinars on this CLUIN system. Also, Sarah Mission and Donnie and Justin are back there taking care of things for everyone, Justin Crane and Jean Balance. So thanks very much to all of you for participating. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your participation, and we are going to conclude the webinar. So I hope everyone has a great rest of the afternoon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.